given us many answers to great questions. Actually, science has enlarged the great question for which we have no answer. This suddenly means to us that whereas a couple of thousand years ago, the universe was so small that a couple of Caesars and Charlemagne could well nigh have built it, the universe today is infinitely greater. There was a time when it was honestly believed that a mortal man could rule the universe. Today we know this isn't so. Today we have come to know as never before the magnitude of this universe. If this is an accident, the accident becomes more fantastic every moment. If this is a machine, the machine transcends any concept of machine that we have ever known or ever thought of. If this is merely a continuance of blind force has developed extrasensory perceptions because there is no evidence of blindness in the great forces that move existence. Out of the entire pageantry of increasing knowledge, the great question of where did it start just gets bigger. Instead of having answers, we merely push back the horizon of our comparative knowing. But as Buddha said, as veil upon veil we lift, we find veil upon veil behind. The universe suddenly emerges as a splendor of laws and processes, of forces and forms, of agencies and energies, utterly beyond the comprehension of man 100 years ago. But these discoveries do not make an atheist, nor do they really give much comfort or consolation to an honest agnostic. They simply confront us with the continuing need for an answer that actually answers the problems as they are. And the answer is not forthcoming. We get more and more questions, and occasionally a little discovery is handed out to us on a platter to cause us to no longer question. But actually, there are more questions at this moment than ever before in the history of man. We have, therefore, to come in the end to one of two conclusions. And the second one isn't much good. The first conclusion is, as Sir James Jeans finally realized, that there is only one answer, namely, that there is a conscious principle at the source of life. That this universe is not an accident. That the whole concept of accident is simply a human stupidity. That even in the careers of people, what we call an accident is not what it seems to be. And certainly there is no record that a series of accidents could bring forth a galaxy. We study these factors as we can see them. We realize the infinite pageantry of orderly processes. We suddenly realize that we are living in a universe which becomes, as far as we can see, the only staple thing in existence. We come into the presence of wonder after miracle, and we are expected to view this tremendous fact without responding to the instinctive and inevitable power within ourselves, which would of itself bring us to our knees. No longer to our knees in servile acceptance, but to our knees in simple, natural humility. Bring us to the realization that we do exist within a pattern, within a plan, which is worthy of our understanding and which quietly but inevitably requires our obedience. Now, this does not throw us into a mass of superstitions. We do not have to become concerned about an elderly gentleman with a long gray beard who tosses the sun off in front and the moon behind. We are no longer required to assume that the earth was slipped under man at some remote time when he started to fall so that he wouldn't keep on falling. These things we do not need. But we do need to realize that this vastness which we can perceive, a part at least, and this infinite order which we can behold, a part at least, inevitably requires, as the ancient Chaldean said, the existence of a principle of principles, a power over powers, a tremendous purposeness unfolding itself eternally through this multitude of ever-evolving worlds. This we have to face. And this, perhaps, is the beginning of our new religion. This is the beginning of a series of simple moral conclusions, built firmly upon everything that we know. See, one of our earlier mistakes was to try to make religion strong by weakening every other form of knowledge, to try to preserve religious dogma, if necessary, by the sacrifice of fact. This we have learned to be a mistake. We now know that the unfoldment of religion must be an unfoldment in harmony with fact, that we cannot afford to believe anything that is contrary to the operations of laws which we can actually experience. There may be much more than we can experience, but we have no right to assume that that which we do experience is not a lawful part of that which is still unknown. So our philosophy and our religion must be kept sufficiently open so that into it can be built all new knowledge without interfering with honorable belief. Thus our beliefs must be as broad and deep in the beginning as possible. And there can be no dogma, there can be no prejudice which can prevent us from accepting that which is known to be true. If therefore faith builds in harmony with the known fact of things, this faith will not run into the difficulties that we have previously encountered. We can therefore continue to glorify the cause of all things, and the source of all things, and to recognize that new knowledge is merely a further revelation of universal glory, that there can be no conflict, that when we discover that there is something smaller than these minute atoms with which we are now concerned, this does not overthrow theology. It simply gives us another new and deeper understanding or insight into the mystery of universal religion. So we can, to a measure at least, benefit by some of our Buddhist brethren who at an early time decided that there would be no conflict between religion and science, and therefore there has never been a scientific discovery that conflicts with Buddhism. Because Buddhism simply won't be conflicted with. It has no dogma. Buddha, by his own psychological and almost scientific mind, realized the danger of dogma and realized the fact that finally man must experience that all true knowledge is good and that the individual who has the greatest understanding of facts has the greatest capacity for religion. If this gets to be rather fashionable in the West, it may help us out of one of our problems. It will certainly end squabbling over things which are not important. and will allow us to face the universe in the search of God, rather than to lock ourselves in a mass of small problems. When we were a small people living in small towns, in small countries, where our knowledge was seldom extended beyond the ABCs and our only text was the Bible, where man worked from dawn to dark to merely provide himself for the necessities of life, we lived in a small world. We thought small thoughts, and we could argue and wrangle over small matters. But this has changed. We now live in a large world, which demands large thoughts. And large thoughts and little thoughts cannot live in the same mind. If the little thoughts dominate, we're a bigot. If the big thoughts dominate, we move victoriously toward true religious insight. Now, if we get to the point, then, where we can begin to recognize the principle of deity as universal consciousness, we do not know what universal consciousness means. We do not know what human consciousness is. But we know that there is a mysterious something of aliveness in us by which we are self-aware, by which also we plan destiny, by which we love and fear, hope and think, by which all our various attitudes and opinions are motivated and vitalized, and by which we can say we are a person. This mass of energy within ourselves, a luminous kind of self-knowing energy, we like to think of as consciousness. We also like to assume that consciousness directs action, that if man did not have a life within himself, he couldn't move. If the universe did not have a life within itself, it couldn't move. Corpses do not continue their normal living functions, and a lifeless universe will not. We also know from our researches that planets and suns and worlds are born and die. Therefore, life and death as we know it exist in space. Consequently, there is consciousness, which can depart from suns and moons and planets in the same way that it can depart from human beings. Therefore, there has to be a principle of life. Otherwise, this principle of life could not be either nearer nor further, nor could it be present nor depart. And in this tremendous recognition, we begin to see the magnitude of a proper God realization. And this God realization manifests through its most natural and obvious attributes, not through particular persons. Its priesthood is the stars and the earth and the mountains. For everywhere, nature itself bears witness. It is nature vested in the robes of glory. It is nature, the high priest of the divine mysteries. And we perceive everywhere these laws, these qualities, these ethics and cultures essential in nature, in the universe. Otherwise, they could not be experienced by any single creature fashioned out of this common stuff. Thus, we have the basis for morality, for ethics, for culture, for belief, for vision, for hope, and for faith. Because we live in a universe in which all of these can be justified by facts. The great fact being the sovereignty of the total within which we exist. Now, if we wish to assume this, it is only one very simple step to Plato's next concept. Namely, that this consciousness, being the total and sole director of all that exists, is in a strange way the only and complete despot. Here is the only actual authority. There is no authority other than the authority of cosmic consciousness itself. Now, cosmic consciousness, from what we are able to learn, is no respecter of persons. It does not compromise its own principles to please any set of rules set up by man. Cosmic consciousness does that which cosmic consciousness, experiencing within itself, knows to be true and inevitable. Therefore, cosmic consciousness becomes its own only critic, its only censor. Nothing can govern it but itself. And that which it wills, that which it determines, that which it resolves, out of the infinite totality of its own nature, has to be. And why should man not acknowledge the simple fact that whatever this cosmic consciousness ordains, decrees, and wills, this must be good? We can object to it, but in a strange way, our objections are not even overruled. Nobody is aware of them but ourselves. We can shake our fist at heaven. It has been done before. But as the old American Indian story says, the moon is not disturbed by the howling of wolves. Nothing that we say or nothing that we do can have any more effect than the sovereign power of Canute the Dane, who found that all his sovereignty couldn't hold back the tide. Nothing that we think about, wish for, hope for, or believe has any validity unless it is in absolute accordance with sovereignty itself. Also, we must assume that as there can be nothing else, that we cannot say that the nature of consciousness is good and evil. Consciousness cannot be good and evil, because consciousness can be only itself, and that which is itself has to be good. There is no other way in which it can function. Now, we could say, if we wanted to, that this consciousness could become very temperamental, and it could do a number of absurd things. Yet if this consciousness was absurd, absurdity would still be law, because there is no recourse beyond it. But we have no evidence that this consciousness is absurd. We have no reason whatsoever to assume that any conclusion of this consciousness is unrealistic. So we assume, and have to assume, that it is good. And that we must also assume that we cannot escape from it, whether we like it or not. No matter how far we go into space, we can never escape it. We can never reach a point where we are not under the governorship of it. For could we theoretically reach its extremity, we would cease because we are part of it. So the part can never escape from the whole, and the part can never be greater than the whole. So we are, so we say, stuck. Now the experience of this is perhaps the most beautiful religious experience in life, for it suddenly places us in the midst of a plan that rests in a power which alone has absolute consciousness. The only thing in the universe that knows where the universe is going is the consciousness that ensouls it. Planets, suns, moons, stars, elements, creatures do not know. But as the only thing within man that knows where man is trying to go is his own consciousness, so the only thing in space that knows its own purpose is that consciousness which ensouls space. Thus, it is not within our ordinary possibility to argue the matter, to discuss it fluently, or to have many opinions about it. As the Eastern philosopher realizes, in the presence of this great fact, All that we have is the personal right of complete acceptance. Now, this acceptance is a little trick in itself, because we all have to accept finally. But we can accept in a series of ways. We can grudgingly accept. We can accept only when we have exhausted every effort to avoid acceptance. We can go down to glorious defeat, shaking our fist at the inevitable. But this acceptance will come. And the wise person is the one who accepts in the first place. Whereas the Greek philosopher pointed out, the difference between a fool and a wise man is simply this, that a wise man loves to do what a fool has to do. And this is our problem in space. We are confronted by this inevitable. And here is the beginning of our religion. Our religion must be perhaps the simplest the world has ever known. For all that we have to make this religion is that we shall ensoul knowledge with faith. In other words, without faith, knowledge is meaningless. But with faith, knowledge becomes a constant means of strengthening our inner conviction about the great truth of the thing as it is. So all we really need is to have a faith great enough so that the mistakes of men cannot overthrow it. A faith strong enough to survive the struggle between knowledge and ignorance that must take place within ourselves before faith can be secure. Faith, actually, is merely this acceptance, but a beautiful acceptance, an acceptance with rejoicing. And here the Greeks did a rather better job of it than we do, because most of their religious festivals were occasions of great joy. Most of these people did not worship in fear and in tears. They were not very much concerned with sin. Because, after all, sin is only a mistake to begin with. And why get all worked up over it? The main thing is to continue to grow towards a realization of the beauty of life itself. If we become sufficiently aware of the magnificence of the universal plan, we will get over our sins in due course. But the most important thing is to rejoice in the magnificent acceptance which our consciousness makes possible for us. The Greeks were much concerned with consciousness, although, strangely enough, they never had the word. They used other words to signify it. But they did concern themselves with its meaning. And their concept was that the great experience in life is for man to become aware of the universe, not only as sovereign power, but as the most beautiful thing existing in anywhere in the universal reality. For deity is not only this absolute truth, this absolute principle, this absolute wisdom, this immutable law, but deity is a magnificent snowflake-like structure of infinite geometric perfection, the most splendid and adorable form in the entire world. So to become aware of the universal plan is to become immersed in the beauty and the sublimity of this vastness which exceeds us in every way. We really should be able to raise our heads to heaven and laugh not at heaven, but with heaven, at the very sheer joy of existing. And this should not be the laugh of a hypocrite, nor should be the laugh of a tyrant. It should be the laugh of a small child that has just discovered a butterfly. It should be the laugh of the growing one reaching out to grasp the stars. It is the true laughter of sheer joy within the heart and the soul in the presence of great beauty. So out of these principles come a series of natural reactions that do not have to be especially violent or especially dramatic. They are simply a series of gradually unfolding acceptances. Now, when man comes to this conclusion about the universe, he naturally asks about his own relationship to it. Man was created. Man is a product of cosmic consciousness. Just how, we don't know. But what else could he be a product of? If there is only one immutable and inevitable consciousness permeating all things, and this consciousness, as all theologians will admit of God, is the supreme power, where else could man have come from? Can we conceive of man as anything except one of the unfolding expressions of this cosmic purpose? Man in some way is necessary. We now begin to realize as we look around that there's scarcely a single gnat or bug that isn't necessary. This gives us hope. There may be reason for us. But we discover that whenever we unbalance nature, if we get rid of too many ants from the side of a hill, or take too many bugs out from under the edge of a log, something goes wrong. We have disturbed natural balance. Well, man has been disturbing natural balance in his own way for a long time. But we are encouraged by the thought that the absence of man might unbalance nature even further. It doesn't seem possible at the moment, but I think there is still a probability. Man is part of this pattern. Man is an integral part of the unfoldment of consciousness toward the self-realization of its own nature. Consciousness in space is very difficult for us to localize. The Egyptians tried to see it in the many-rayed figure of the sun. Various peoples have created emblems of it. But gradually, philosophic nations have come to the conclusion that the consciousness in man is perhaps our most perfect symbol of the universal consciousness. So there's something growing up in man, something that needs man just as much as man needs it. And in this universe, man is an inevitable structure. And his appearance and his bodily form and function, these things probably differ with all possible environments in space, but we have no reason to doubt that intelligent creatures of some kind, with varying degrees of consciousness, greater or lesser than our own, inhabit every planet in the entire galaxy that we can see. So man is important in his own small but very significant way. Consequently, it is inconceivable to assume that man's purpose does not abide forever in the divine mind. Man's purpose is part of universal purpose. Man is not merely a passing experiment to be tried and thrown away. Man has endured a long time and suffered much. He has worked and labored to build by degrees what small conscious understanding he has attained. Perhaps he has been working, according to conservative anthropologists, for 1 million years. They're pushing the dates back every day. Perhaps he has been working 100 million years in forms no longer regarded as human. But he has been struggling up from the unknown, up from the inadequate, towards the gradual estate which he has presently attained. Therefore, there is absolutely no reason to assume or suppose that man is essentially merely an incident, that man is expendable. He is not expendable any more than an atom is expendable. There is a reason for him. And the problem he must try to do is to understand that reason. And if he can't understand the reason because he doesn't have as yet sufficient insight, then he has to accept that reason and consider it quite reasonable that a universe in which everything is well regulated did not create him by accident. So man's part in the plan is essentially in that plan and of that plan and is not divisible from it. So man becomes quietly, modestly important. Now if man has any reason whatsoever for his existence, certainly we have to search for two kinds of reason. We have to search for the little reasons that men have. And as we add those all together and examine them, we find out they don't add up to much. The reasons that we most commonly give for our own survival or our own existence are not of any great importance. There is really nothing that man has accomplished in industry that can't be at least archetypally associated with an ant. We are not really more successful in most of our enterprises than the members of lesser kingdoms with greater limitation of faculty and power. So that man's real purpose has to have something to do with this fact that man is the only creature that we know of that can plan his own destiny consciously. That man is the only creature that knows and remembers that he was born and knows that he will die. These peculiar forms of knowledge separate him from every other creature. Therefore, they have something to do with the significance of his place in space. So, considering the fact that we are living in a vast universe of life and not in a universal graveyard, there is no reason to assume, by common sense or by any other reason, that man individually has no purpose. Because man's consciousness is individual. The idea that man has a collective purpose, such as to leave more apartment houses to his children than he inherited when he was born, doesn't mean anything, because nature isn't concerned with these things. But the facts also indicate that collective salvation, or the idea that man is merely to be saved through his progeny, doesn't really mean anything. Because the only part of man that is his own conscious nature is his own. The growing child is not the inheritor of the parent's consciousness because the parent is still alive and has it. The consciousness of the child belongs to itself. The consciousness of the parent belongs to itself. And it is this consciousness which is its universal part. Consequently, it is part of the inevitable purpose of life that if it individualizes consciousness as it has in man, it is not going to save that consciousness by causing it to cease to be individual and become part of a collective lump. This is not the purpose that nature intended. The only point in which consciousness, as a factor, ceases to have individual significance is when that consciousness is ultimately reunited with the infinite consciousness itself. Certainly death is no answer to any of these questions. And man is forced to conclude that if the universal consciousness knows what it is doing, man has to be immortal. There is just no other answer. Because otherwise, the universe is creating something only to destroy it. And in destroying it, to destroy all the attainment that this thing has achieved down through thousands of years of growth. This is not thinkable in a well-ordered universe. Any more than it would be thinkable that we would allow our children to suffer until they're 21 years old and then shoot them. This does not make sense in our lives nor in the universe. We are compelled to assume that immortality is inevitable. Now, we are not sure just what we mean by immortality. Perhaps by immortality we mean the survival of our own consciousness in universal consciousness. Perhaps we are forced to admit with Aristotle that this is not absolute. Perhaps we can say that this solar system, this cosmic system to which we belong, has a duration of only a certain number of billions of years. And then that the consciousness in this will also go to sleep in some vaster mystery. That we don't object to immediately. But as far as we are concerned, immortality means a continuity of consciousness after death over a vast period of time, perhaps infinite, but certainly great enough to enable the full harvesting of the purpose for which man was created. So we have really no choice but immortality. We don't have to have any dogma. We don't have to say to a man, if you don't believe it, you're going to be damned. Well, all we have to say to him really is, if you don't believe it, you're just going to be stupid. Because it makes no difference whether we believe it or not. And we have damned many people merely for the sin of stupidity. And sometimes the damning was due to our stupidity, not theirs. So the simple problem stands that the immortality of man is a natural discovery resulting from our gradual increasing understanding of the immortality of space. We have suddenly come into a bigger world. Therefore, we have to adjust to it. And the only way we can adjust to it, really, is to realize that we are a part of something bigger than we thought existed. This should not be completely unpleasant, because it really is an indication of a basic value more than we have ever suspected. Now, in this situation, we come again, of course, to the great question that confronts everyone. Namely, what about the emergencies by which it seems that all of the progress of man is destroyed, that we might be reduced again to savagery, that we might be forced to hide in holes in the ground to escape the common inhumanity of man. We might have to build a world all over again, or we might be suddenly cast out of this world more suddenly and unexpectedly than we would prefer. What does all this mean in terms of universal justice? Well, again, it all depends on what kind of a world you think you live in, because actually now your religion is based upon your understanding of the universe. In the first place, do we believe, actually, can we believe, that anything within the structure of a living being is actually destructible? We know that things are constantly changing their compounds. We know, as was written on Lord Bacon's grave, that all compounds must be dissolved. We know that change is forever taking place. We know that in consciousness we change. But is a change destruction? Or is a change merely a shifting of a center of awareness or a center of conscious attention from one area to another? Is a change itself an inevitable element of the process of ever-becoming by which we move from a previous to a subsequent condition by means of change? I think our answer rests again in the universe and in what we can see and in what we can know. Namely, that as far as we are able to understand, conceive, or realize, every so-called body, physical structure, or form in nature is only a conditioned energy. That every so-called unit of dead matter is actually a unit of life. That therefore there is no such thing as death anywhere in space. And what we call disintegration is merely an appearance in which a different type of life activity is released. Everywhere we turn in space, there can be only life, and all matter is merely a manifestation, an expression, a form, a condition of life itself. Therefore, if everything is life, then death, as we think of it, as extinction, is not conceivable. Now, is it all further conceivable that consciousness, which is that part of our nature, which is the nearest to the divine nature that we can conceive, that if every element of matter is immortal, which it is, that consciousness of all this compound is the only thing that can die, because our final concern is consciousness itself. If body can be dissolved but not destroyed, if forms break down into eternal living units, which are themselves indestructible, have we any reason to assume that consciousness is destructible? Or have we any reason to assume that as all bodies exist for the purpose of consciousness, that consciousness is less than body? If consciousness is our symbol of God, then we realize that all forms, all bodies, all mutable shapes and structures in nature become instruments for consciousness, that consciousness abides in them and departs from them. The bodies themselves cannot actually cease, but their compounds can be dissolved. Consciousness, therefore, is the one power by which we can know ourselves and be aware of the divine sovereignty which we recognize as pure consciousness in space. And we assume, and I think rightly, that if man's consciousness can cease, God can die. Because God is consciousness. And if consciousness can cease, then anytime, anywhere, deity is vulnerable. Aristotle wouldn't believe that. He therefore liked to assume a universal, eternal, enduring consciousness. If consciousness endures anywhere, it must endure everywhere. And most wise people have come to the conclusion that human consciousness is of itself an immortal fact, and that this consciousness is an expression of the divine universal consciousness, and that therefore what we call human consciousness is the divine growing up in the world which it has fashioned. That this consciousness is inevitable, indestructible, and eternal. Therefore, that this consciousness can never be less. Its forms can change, its purposes and functions can vary, but the substantial fact that there abides in us that which makes us seek the good, this is indestructible. That is part of an inevitable purpose which is inescapable. Though these things are very basic, they do not lead us quickly into a lot of conflicts with our neighbors, because most of the things we have said here so far this evening about these matters are by universal acceptance. They're not always so stated, but they are so implied. Therefore, our difficulties do not lie here. Our difficulties lie in a secondary area. Our primary convictions are much alike everywhere. The Taoists, the Buddhists, the Shintoists, the Orthodox Jew, the Christian, and the Muslim have most of their great spiritual essentials in common. Yet this commonness of value has not prevented a sad confusion of creeds. And the only answer is that this is caused by permitting matters of a high controversial and uncertain nature to be given precedent over certainties. And here is where the house cleaning has got to start. Our religion must be something that is so simple and so essential that we can communicate it in a very short time, and that each point that we attempt to communicate will be in conformity with the best religious, scientific, and philosophical knowledge. That we will be speaking only of things most reasonable, completely probable, and we shall speak of them in a manner which indicates our sincerity, but not our dogmatic determination to force anyone else to the same conclusion. The only way this conclusion can be meaningful is not when it is forced, but when it inevitably arises in us as a medicine for our own insufficiency. Then it becomes vital. So we can clear away all of this rubbish that has to do with things that are nice, things that are pleasant, things loaded with nostalgia, things that gave great consolation and some terrible headaches to our ancestors. But these problems are not necessarily our problems. We are gradually coming beyond the time when we can afford the luxury of theological debate. We are coming to the time when there is no use trying to insist that an individual buy a bill of goods. This is not our purpose. The real purpose of religion today is to expose man to the eternal facts that he has been looking at for ages, but which he never really accepted, because his own training had not fitted him to accept them. But our scientific and cultural training of today makes it possible for us to accept them and to understand them and to justify them and to use science and philosophy to strengthen faith rather than to tear it down. As we stand in the presence of these great laws, we stand in the same presence as all other people of great and good hope. These same laws affect not only man, but every other creature. And we suddenly find that our new religion has space in it for the bugs and the flowers and the trees, something we never got around to in the older ways of thinking. We also realize that we are part of a pattern which we can pass on to our children, and they in turn will enlarge it. And we will not be angry with them because they know more than we do. We will rejoice for them that they have grown further than we have grown. All of the competition of creeds, which is a total waste of time and one of the most horrible causes of holy wars, the most unholy of all wars, these things are a complete loss of motion, meaningless, purposeless. Our great need today is to find the vast unities of life, and on these unities to build strongly the simple proposition that this vast body which we know has a soul, and that this soul in this power, this consciousness, is what we have called God. And we have called it God because we considered it to be ultimate good. We have called it God because we have recognized its infinite power. But now we must call it God because we begin to understand its infinite methods and have discovered that in all these methods, the sovereignty of a conscious divine power is everywhere present and clearly indicated, and that every doubt that we raise in our own mind results ultimately in a new evidence to remove that doubt. Consequently, we can build our own religion. We can build a religion that is large enough to include the faiths of all men. We do not need to disturb these people. We do not need to make religious trouble for them. But because of the motion of our world, we are gradually dividing into two groups of human beings. Those who are trying to grow and those who are trying desperately to cling to something old, which they love and venerate, which is their right, but which may bring upon them a certain suffering because it is not adequate to their present need. Therefore, these people are sick, they are miserable, and they are frightened. Their only solution in nature is to achieve the end they were intended to achieve, that fear shall be the spur which will lead them to a further unfoldment of consciousness. For the only answer to fear is consciousness unfolding faith. If we sense this, we realize that underneath all the doubts and fears and anxieties that we may have, there is this vast movement of life which cannot fail, can never be less than itself, is untouched by the political speculations of anybody, is not primarily concerned with whether capital, labor, or management dominates a situation, a pattern which does not recognize east, west, north, or south. It recognizes only one thing, namely that it is growing up through the vast order of creation which it has fashioned, and that all things that live are the instruments of its own purpose. And that what we call our consciousness is our power to be aware because of the universal power in ourselves, the universal power in all other things. If we simply take this, we then know beyond any question of doubt that our shadows in space will not be less, that all these things that come and go are merely conditions in the ultimate purpose, and that ultimate purpose is the victory of consciousness over every existing or conceivable lack of itself. Or the victory for man in a more immediate sense, the victory of his own consciousness over the darkness of his own ignorance. And to give him the power to do this, one of the old Rosicrucian writers said, "The sovereign power in majesty has given man three sacred books, by means of which he might discover the mystery of himself. One of these books is the universe. The second is his own body with its functions and powers. And the third is the sacred scripture of his people. And these three, if worked together, form the same blending of religion, philosophy, and science, and give us the foundation for a simple natural faith. A faith which is sustained by progress, never offended by progress. For if true progress offends us, our faith is wrong. We must be prepared to meet more knowledge than we have ever known before. And we must meet it with a greater capacity to transform knowledge into consciousness, in order that this growth of consciousness may always bring us peace, a peace arising from our realization of the essential goodness of the plan and the power behind the plan." Well, our time is up, so I think that's all for this evening.